Except it's not the roof of any tunnel, Bill thought. It's Main Street. At least it used to be. I think most of downtown Derry is now in the canal and being carried down the Kenduskeag River. Pretty soon it'll be in the Penobscot, and then it will be in the Atlantic Ocean and good fucking riddance. Can you help me with Audra, Richie? I don't think I can... Sure, Richie said. Sure, Bill. No sweat. He took Audra from Bill. In this light, Bill could see her better than he perhaps wanted to. Her pallor masked but not hidden by the dirt and ordure that smeared her forehead and caked her cheeks. Her eyes were still wide open and innocent of all sense. Her hair hung lank and wet. She might as well have been one of those inflatable dollies they sold at the Pleasure Chest in New York or along the Reeperbahn in Hamburg. The only difference was her low, steady respiration, and that might have been a clockwork trick, no more than that. How are we going to get up from here? He asked Richie. Get Ben to give you 10 fingers, Richie said. You can yank Bev up, and the two of you can get your wife. Ben can boost me, and we'll get Ben. And after that, I'll show you how to set up a volleyball tournament for 1,000 sorority girls. Beep, beep, Richie. Beep, beep your ass, Big Bill. The tiredness was going through him in steady waves. He caught Beverly's level gaze and held it for a moment. She nodded to him slightly, and he made a smile for her. Give me 10 fingers, Bubba Ben. Ben, who also looked unutterably weary, nodded. A deep scratch ran down one cheek. I think I can handle that. He stooped slightly and laced his hands together. Bill hiked one foot, stepped into Ben's hand, and jumped up. It wasn't quite enough. Ben lifted the step he had made with his hands, and Bill grabbed the edge of the broken-in tunnel roof. He yanked himself up. The first thing he saw was a white and orange crash barrier. The second thing was a crowd of milling men and women beyond the barrier. The third was Freese's department store. Only it had an oddly bulged-out, foreshortened look. It took him a moment to realize that almost half of Freese's had sunk into the street and the canal beneath. The top half had slewed out over the street and seemed in danger of toppling over like a pile of badly stacked books. Look, look, there's someone in the street. A woman was pointing toward the place where Bill's head had poked out of the crevasse in the shattered pavement. Praise God, there's someone else. She started forward, an elderly woman with a kerchief tied over her head, peasant style. A cop held her back. Not safe out there, Mrs. Nelson. You know it. Rest of the street might go any time. Mrs. Nelson, Bill thought. I remember you. Your sister used to sit George and me sometimes. He raised his hand to show her he was all right, and when she raised her own hand in return, he felt a sudden surge of good feelings and hope. He turned around and lay flat on the sagging pavement, trying to distribute his weight as evenly as possible, the way you were supposed to do on thin ice. He reached down for Bev. She grasped his wrists, and with what seemed to be the last of his strength, he pulled her up. The sun, which had disappeared again, now ran out from behind a brace of mackerel-scale clouds and gave them their shadows back. Beverly looked up, startled, caught Bill's eyes, and smiled. I love you, Bill, she said, and I pray she'll be all right. The hanky, Bevy, he said, and his kind smile made her start to cry a little. He hugged her, and the small crowd gathered behind the crash barrier applauded. A photographer from the Derry News snapped a picture. It appeared in the June 1st edition of the paper, which was printed in Bangor because of water damage to the news's presses. The caption was simple enough, and true enough for Bill to cut the picture out and keep it tucked away in his wallet for years to come. Survivors, the caption read. That was all, but that was enough. It was 11:06 in Derry, Maine. 7. Derry, later the same day. The glass corridor between the children's library and the adult library had exploded at 10:30 a.m. At 10:33, the rain stopped. It didn't taper off. It stopped all at once, as if someone up there had flicked a toggle switch. The wind had already begun to fall, and it fell so rapidly that people stared at each other with uneasy, superstitious faces. The sound was like the wind down of a 747's engines after it has been safely parked at the gate. The sun peeked out for the first time at 10:47. By mid-afternoon, the clouds had burned away entirely, and the day had come off fair and hot. By 3:30 p.m., the mercury in the orange-crushed thermometer outside the door of Second-Hand Rose, Second-Hand Clothes, read 83, the highest reading of the young season. People walked through the streets like zombies, not talking much. Their expressions were remarkably similar. A kind of stupid wonder that would have been funny if it was not so frankly pitiable. By evening, reporters from ABC, CBS, NBC, and CNN had arrived in Derry, and the network news reporters would bring some version of the truth home to most people. They would make it real, although there were those who might have suggested that reality is a highly untrustworthy concept, something perhaps no more solid than a piece of canvas stretched over an interlacing of cables like the strands of a spider web. The following morning, Bryant Gumbel and Willard Scott of the Today Show would be in Derry. During the course of the program, Gumbel would interview Andrew Keene. "Whole standpipe just crashed over and rolled down the hill," Andrew said. "It was like, wow, you know what I mean? Like Steven Spielberg, eat your heart out, you know? Hey, I always got the idea looking at you on TV that you were, you know, a lot bigger." Seeing themselves and their neighbors on TV, that would make it real. It would give them a place from which to grasp this terrible, ungraspable thing. It had been a freak storm. In the days following, the death count would rise in the wake of the killer storm. It was, in fact, the worst spring storm in Maine history. All of these headlines, as terrible as they were useful. They helped to blunt the essential strangeness of what had happened. Or perhaps strangeness was too mild a word. Insanity might have been better. Seeing themselves on TV would help make it concrete, less insane. But in the hours before the news crews arrived, there were only the people from Derry, walking through their rubble-strewn, mud-slick streets with expressions of stunned unbelief on their faces. Only the people from Derry, not talking much, looking at things, occasionally picking things up and then tossing them down again, trying to figure out what had happened during the last 7 or 8 hours. Men stood on Kansas Street, smoking, looking at houses lying upside down in the barrens. Other men and women stood beyond the white and orange crash barriers, looking into the black hole that had been downtown until 10 that morning. The headline of that Sunday's paper read, "We will rebuild," vows Derry Mayor. And perhaps they would. But in the weeks that followed, while the city council wrangled over how the rebuilding should begin, the huge crater that had been downtown continued to grow in an unspectacular but steady way. 4 days after the storm, the office building of the Bangor Hydroelectric Company collapsed into the hole. 3 days after that, the Flying Dog House, which sold the best kraut and chili dogs in eastern Maine, fell in. Drains backed up periodically in houses, apartment buildings, and businesses. It got so bad in the old Cape that people began to leave. June 10th was the first evening of horse racing at Basie Park. The first pace was scheduled for 8 p.m., and that seemed to cheer everyone up. But a section of bleachers collapsed as the trotters in the first race turned into the home stretch, and a half a dozen people were hurt. One of them was Foxy Foxworth, who had managed the Aladdin Theater until 1973. Foxy spent 2 weeks in the hospital, suffering from a broken leg and a punctured testicle. When he was released, he decided to go to his sister's in Somersworth, New Hampshire. He wasn't the only one. Derry was falling apart. 8. They watched the orderly slam the back doors of the ambulance and go around to the passenger seat. The ambulance started up the hill toward the Derry Home Hospital. Richie had flagged it down at severe risk of life and limb and had argued the irate driver to a draw when the driver insisted he just didn't have any more room. He had ended up stretching Audra out on the floor. "Now what?" Ben asked. There were huge brown circles under his eyes and a grimy ring of dirt around his neck. "I'm going back to the townhouse," Bill said. "Gonna sleep for about 16 hours. "I second that," Richie said. He looked hopefully at Bev. "Got any cigarettes, pretty lady?" "No," Beverly said. "I think I'm going to quit again." "Sensible enough idea." They began to walk slowly up the hill, the four of them side by side. "It's over," Bill said. Ben nodded. "We did it. You did it, Big Bill." "We all did it," Beverly said. "I wish we could have brought Eddie up. I wish that more than anything." They reached the corner of Upper Main and Point Street. A kid in a red rain slicker and green rubber boots was sailing a paper boat along the brisk run of water in the gutter. He looked up, saw them looking at him, and waved tentatively. Bill thought it was the boy with the skateboard, the one whose friend had seen Jaws in the canal. He smiled and stepped toward the boy. "It's all right, Ninanow," he said. The boy studied him gravely and then grinned. The smile was sunny and hopeful.
"Yeah," he said. "I think it is."
"Bet your ass." The kid laughed. "You gonna be careful on the hat skateboard?"
"Not really," the kid said,
and this time Bill laughed. He restrained an urge to ruffle the kid's hair. That probably would have been resented, and returned to the others. "Who was that?" Richie asked.
"A friend," Bill said. He stuffed his hands in his pockets. "Do you remember it? When we came out before?"
Beverly nodded.
"Eddie got us back to the Barrens. Only we ended up on the other side of the Kanduskeag somehow. The old Cape side."
"You and Haystack pushed the lid off one of those pumping stations," Richie said to Bill,
"because you had the most weight."
"Yeah," Ben said, "we did. The sun was out, but it was almost down."
"Yeah," Bill said, "and we were all there."
"But nothing lasts forever," Richie said. He looked back down the hill they had just climbed and sighed. "Look at this, for instance." He held his hands out. The tiny scars in the palms were gone. Beverly put her hands out. Ben did the same. Bill added his. All were dirty, but unmarked.
"Nothing lasts forever," Richie repeated.
He looked up at Bill, and Bill saw tears cut slowly through the dirt on Richie's cheeks.
"Except maybe for love," Ben said.
"And desire," Beverly said.
"How about friends?" Bill asked and smiled. "What do you think, Trash Mouth?"
"Well," Richie said, smiling and rubbing his eyes,
"I got to think about it, boy. I say, I got to think about it."
Bill put his hands out and they joined theirs with his and stood there for a moment. Seven who had been reduced to four but who could still make a circle. They looked at each other. Ben was crying now too, the tears spilling from his eyes. But he was smiling.
"I love you guys so much," he said.
He squeezed Bev's and Richie's hands tight, tight, tight for a moment, and then dropped them.
"Now could we see if they've got such a thing as breakfast in this place? And we ought to call Mike, tell him we're okay."
"Good thinning, Senhor," Richie said. "Every now and then I think you might turn out okay. What you think, Big Bill?"
"I think you ought to go fuck yourself," Bill said.
They walked into the townhouse on a wave of laughter, and as Bill pushed through the glass door, Beverly caught sight of something which she never spoke of but never forgot. For just a moment, she saw their reflections in the glass. Only there were six, not four, because Eddie was behind Richie, and Stan was behind Bill, that little half-smile on his face. 9. Out. Dusk, August 10th, 1958. The sun sits neatly on the horizon, a slightly oblate red ball that throws a flat, feverish light over the barrens. The iron cover on top of one of the pumping stations rises a little, settles, rises again, and begins to slide.
Push it, Ben. It's breaking my shoulder.
The cover slides farther, tilts, and falls into the shrubbery that has grown up around the concrete cylinder. Seven children come out one by one and look around, blinking owlishly in silent wonder. They are like children who have never seen daylight before.
"It's so quiet," Beverly says softly.
The only sounds are the loud rush of water and the somnolent hum of insects. The storm is over, but the Kanduskeag is still very high. Closer to town, not far from the place where the river is corseted in concrete and called a canal, it has overflowed its banks. Although the flooding is by no means serious, a few wet cellars is the worst of it. This time. Stan moves away from them, his face blank and thoughtful. Bill looks around, and at first he thinks Stan has seen a small fire on the riverbank. Fire is his first impression, a red glow almost too bright to look at. But when Stan picks the fire up in his right hand, the angle of the light changes, and Bill sees it's nothing but a Coke bottle, one of the new clear ones which someone has dropped by the river. He watches as Stan reverses it, holds it by the neck, and brings it down on a shelf of rock jutting out of the bank. The bottle breaks, and Bill is aware they are all watching Stan now as he pokes through the shattered remains of the bottle, his face sober and studious and absorbed. At last he picks up a narrow wedge of glass. The westering sun throws red glints from it, and Bill thinks again, like a fire. Stan looks up at him, and Bill suddenly understands. It is perfectly clear to him and perfectly right.
He steps forward towards Stan with his hands held out, palms up. Stan backs away into the water. Small black bugs stitch along just above the surface, and Bill can see an iridescent dragonfly go buzzing off into the reeds along the far bank like a small flying rainbow. A frog begins a steady bass thud, and as Stan takes his left hand and draws the edge of glass down his palm, peeling skin and bringing thin blood, Bill thinks in a kind of ecstasy, there's so much life down here. Bill? Sure, both. Stan cuts his other hand. There is pain, but not much. A whippoorwill has begun to call somewhere, a cool sound, peaceful. Bill thinks, that whippoorwill is raising the moon. He looks at his hands, both of them bleeding now, and then around him. The others are there, Eddie with his aspirator clutched tightly in one hand. Ben with his big belly pushing palely out through the tattered remains of his shirt. Richie, his face oddly naked without his glasses. Mike, silent and solemn, his normally full lips compressed to a thin line. And Beverly, her head up, her eyes wide and clear, her hair still somehow lovely in spite of the dirt that mats it. All of us are here. And he sees them, really sees them, for the last time, because in some way he understands that they will never all be together again, the seven of them, not this way. No one talks. Beverly holds out her hands, and after a moment Richie and Ben hold out theirs. Mike and Eddie do the same. Stan cuts them one by one as the sun begins to slip behind the horizon, cooling that red furnace glow to a dusky rose pink. The whippoorwill cries again. Bill can see the first faint swirls of mist on the water, and he feels as if he has become a part of everything. This is a brief ecstasy which he will no more talk about than Beverly will later talk about the brief reflection she sees of two dead men who were, as boys, her friends. A breeze touches the trees and bushes, making them sigh, and he thinks, this is a lovely place, and I'll never forget it. It's lovely. And they are lovely. Each one of them is gorgeous. The whippoorwill cries again, sweet and liquid, and for a moment Bill feels at one with it, as if he could sing and then be gone into the dusk, as if he could fly away, brave in the air. He looks at Beverly, and she is smiling at him. She closes her eyes and holds her hands out to either side. Bill takes her left, Ben her right. Bill can feel the warmth of her blood mixing with his own. The others join in, and they stand in a circle, all of their hands now sealed in that peculiarly intimate way. Stan is looking at Bill with a kind of urgency, a kind of fear.
Swear to me that you'll come back, Bill says. Swear to me that if it isn't dead, you'll come back.
Swear,
Ben said.
Swear,
Richie.
Yes, I swear,
Bev.
Swear it,
Mike Hanlon mutters.
Yeah, swear.
Eddie, his voice a thin and reedy whisper.
I swear too,
Stan whispers, but his voice falters and he looks down as he speaks.
I swear.
That was it. That was all. But they stand there for a while longer, feeling the power that is in their circle, the closed body that they make. The light paints their faces in pale, fading colors. The sun is now gone and sunset is dying. They stand together in a circle as the darkness creeps down into the barrens, filling up the paths they have walked this summer, the clearings where they have played tag and guns, the secret places along the river banks where they have sat and discussed childhood's long questions, or smoked Beverly's cigarettes, or where they have merely been silent, watching the passage of the clouds reflected in the water. The eye of the day is closing. At last, Ben drops his hands. He starts to say something, shakes his head, and walks away. Richie follows him, then Beverly and Mike walking together. No one talks. They climb the embankment to Kansas Street and simply take leave of one another. And when Bill thinks it over 27 years later, he realizes that they really never did all get together again. Four of them quite often, sometimes five, and maybe six once or twice, but never all seven. He's the last to go. He stands for a long time with his hands on the rickety white fence, looking down into the barrens as, overhead, the first stars seed the summer sky. He stands under the blue and over the black and watches the barrens fill up with darkness.
I never want to play down there again,
he thinks suddenly, and is amazed to find the thought is not terrible or distressing, but tremendously liberating. He stands there a moment longer and then turns away from the barons and starts home, walking along the dark sidewalk with his hands in his pockets, glancing from time to time at the houses of Derry, warmly lit against the night. After a block or two, he begins to walk faster, thinking of supper. And a block or two after that, he begins to whistle. Derry, the last interlude. The ocean in these times is a perfect fleet of ships, and we can hardly fail to encounter many in running over. It is merely crossing, said Mr. Micawber, trifling with his eyeglass. Merely crossing. The distance is quite imaginary. Charles Dickens, David Copperfield. June 4th, 1985. Bill came in about 20 minutes ago and brought me this book. Carol found it on one of the tables in the library and gave it to him when he asked for it. I thought Chief Rademacher might have taken it, but apparently he didn't want anything to do with it. Bill's stutter is disappearing again, but the poor man has aged 4 years in the last 4 days. He told me he expects Audra to be discharged from Derry Home Hospital, where I myself yet tarry, tomorrow, only to take a private ambulance north to the Bangor Mental Health Institute. Physically, she's fine. Minor cuts and bruises that are already healing. Mentally, you raise her hand and it stays up, Bill said. He was sitting by the window, twiddling a can of diet soda between his hands. It just floats there until someone puts it down again. Her reflexes are there, but very slow. The EEG they did shows a severely repressed alpha wave. She's catatonic, Mike. I said, I've got an idea. Maybe not such a good one. If you don't like it, just say so. What? I'm going to be in here another week, I said. Instead of sending Audra up to Bangor, why don't you take her to my place, Bill? Spend the week with her. Talk to her, even if she doesn't talk back. Is she continent? No, Bill said bleakly. Would you? Would I change her? He smiled, and it was such a painful smile that I had to look away for a moment. It was the way my father smiled the time he told me about Butch Bowers and the chickens. Yes, I think I could do that much. I won't tell you to take it easy on yourself when you're obviously not prepared to do that, I said. But please remember that you yourself agreed that much or all of what's happened was almost certainly ordained. That may include Audra's part in this. I should have kept my mouth shut about where I was going. Sometimes it's better to say nothing, so that's what I did. All right, he said at last, if you really mean it. I mean it. They've got my house keys down at the patient services desk. There's a couple of Delmonico steaks in the freezer. Maybe that was ordained, too. She's eating mostly soft foods and liquids. Well, I said, holding on to my smile, maybe there'll be a cause for a celebration. There's a pretty good bottle of wine on the top shelf in the pantry, too. Mondavi. Domestic, but good. He came over and gripped my hand. Thank you, Mike. Anytime, Big Bill. He let go of my hand. Richie flew back to California this morning. I nodded. Think you'll stay in touch? Maybe, he said. For a while, anyway. But he looked at me levelly. It's going to happen again, I think. The forgetting? Yes. In fact, I think it's already started. Just little things so far, details. But I think it's going to spread. Maybe that's best. Maybe. He looked out the window, still twiddling his can of diet soda, almost surely thinking about his wife, so wide-eyed and silent and beautiful and plastic. Catatonic. The sound of a door slamming shut and locked. He sighed. Maybe it is. Ben, Beverly? He looked back at me and smiled a little. Ben's invited her to come back to Nebraska with him, and she's agreed to go, at least for a while. You know about her friend in Chicago? I nodded. Beverly told Ben, and Ben told me yesterday. If I may understate the case, grotesquely understate the case, Beverly's later description of her wonderful, fantastic husband, Tom, was much truer than her original one. Wonderful, fantastic Tom kept Bev in emotional, spiritual, and sometimes physical bondage for the last 4 years or so. Wonderful Fantastic Tom got here by beating the information out of Bev's only close woman friend. She told me she's going to fly back to Chicago the week after next and file a missing persons report on him. Tom, I mean. Smart enough, I said. No one's ever going to find him down there. Or Eddie either, I thought, but did not say. No, I suppose not, Bill said. And when she goes back, I'm betting Ben will go with her. And you know something else? Something really crazy? What? I don't think she really remembers what happened to Tom. I just stared at him. She's forgotten or forgetting, Bill said. And I can't remember what the doorway looked like anymore. The doorway into its place. I try to think of it, and the craziest thing happens. I get this image of ghosts walking over a bridge. From that story, The Three Billy Goats Gruff. Crazy, huh? They'll trace Tom Rogan to Derry eventually, I said. He'll have left a paper trail a mile wide. Rent a car, plane tickets. I'm not so sure of that, Bill said, lighting a cigarette. I think he may have paid cash for his plane ticket and given a phony name. Maybe bought a cheap car here, or stole one. Why? Oh, come on, Bill said. Do you think he came all this way to give her a spanking? Our eyes met for a long moment, and then he stood up. Listen, Mike. Two hip got a split, I said. I can dig it. He laughed at that, laughed hard, and when he had sobered, he said, Thanks for the use of your place, Mikey. I'm not going to swear to you it'll make any difference. It has no therapeutic qualities that I'm aware of. Well, I'll see you. He did an odd thing then, odd but rather lovely. He kissed my cheek. God bless, Mike. I'll be around. Things may be okay, Bill, I said. Don't give up hope. They may be okay. He smiled and nodded, but I think the same word was in both of our minds. Catatonic. June 5th, 1985. Ben and Beverly came in today to say goodbye. They're not flying. Ben's rented a great big Cadillac from the Hertz people, and they're going to drive, not hurrying. There's something in their eyes when they look at each other, and I'd bet my pension plan that if they're not making it now, they will be by the time they get to Nebraska. Beverly hugged me, told me to get well quickly, and then cried. Ben also hugged me and asked me for the third or fourth time if I would write. I told him I would indeed write, and so I will, for a while at least. Because this time it's happening to me as well. I'm forgetting things. As Bill said, right now it's only small things, details. But it feels like the sort of thing that's going to spread. It could be that in a month or a year, this notebook will be all I'll have to remind me of what happened here in Derry. I suppose the words themselves might begin to fade, eventually leaving this book as blank as when I first picked it up in the school supplies department at Freese's. That's an awful thought, and in the daytime it seems wildly paranoid. But do you know, in the watches of the night it seems perfectly logical. This forgetting, the prospect fills me with panic, but it also offers a sneaking sort of relief. It suggests to me more than anything else that this time they really did kill it. That there is no need of a watchman to stand and wait for the cycle to begin again. Dull panic, sneaking relief. It's the relief I'll embrace, I think, sneaking or not. Bill called to say he and Audra had moved in. There is no change in her. I'll always remember you. That's what Beverly told me just before she and Ben left. I think I saw a different truth in her eyes. June 6th, 1985. Interesting piece in the Derry News today on page 1. The story was headed, Storm Causes Henley to Give Up Auditorium Expansion Plans. The Henley in question is Tim Henley, a multimillionaire developer who came into Derry like a whirlwind in the late 60s. It was Henley and Zittner who organized the consortium responsible for building the Derry Mall, which, according to another piece on page 1, is probably going to be declared a total loss. Tim Henley was determined to see Derry grow. There was a profit motive, yes indeed, but there was more to it than that. Henley genuinely wanted to see it happen. His sudden abandonment of the auditorium expansion suggests several things to me. That Henley may have soured on Derry is only the most obvious. I think it's also possible that he's in the process of losing his shirt because of the destruction of the mall. But the article also suggests that Henley is not alone.
that other investors and potential investors in Derry's future may be rethinking their options. Of course, Al Zitner won't have to bother. God retired him when downtown collapsed. Of the others, those who thought like Henley are now facing a rather difficult problem. How do you rebuild an urban area which is now at least 50% underwater? I think that, after a long and ghoulishly vital existence, Derry may be dying, like a nightshade whose time to bloom has come and gone. Called Bill Denbrough late this afternoon, no change in Audra. An hour ago, I put through another call, this one to Richie Tozier in California. His answering machine fielded the call, with Creedence Clearwater Revival music playing in the background. Those machines always fuck up my timing somehow. I left my name and number, hesitated, and added that I hoped he was able to wear his contact lenses again. I was about to hang up when Richie himself picked up the phone and said, "Mikey, how you be?" His voice was pleased and warm, but there was an obvious bewilderment there as well. He was wearing the verbal expression of a man who had been caught utterly flat-footed. "Hello, Richie," I said. "I'm doing pretty well." "Good. How much pain you having?" "Some. It's going away. The itch is worse. I'll be damn glad when they finally decide to unstrap my ribs. By the way, I like the Creedence." Richie laughed. "Shit, that ain't Creedence. That's Rock and Roll Girls from Fogerty's new album. Center Field, it's called. You haven't heard any of it?" "Uh-uh." "You got to get it. It's great. It's just like..." He trailed off for a moment and then said, "It's just like the old days." "I'll pick it up," I said, "and I probably will. I always liked John Fogerty. Green River was my all-time Creedence favorite, I guess." "Get back home," he says. "Just before the fade," he says it. "What about Bill?" "He and Audra are keeping house for me while I'm in here." "Good. That's good." He paused for a moment. "You want to hear something fucking bizarre, old Mikey?" "Sure," I said. I had a pretty good idea what he was going to say. "Well, I was sitting here in my study, listening to some of the new Cashbox hot prospects, going over some ad copy, reading memos. There's about two mountains of stuff backed up. And I'm looking at roughly a month of 25-hour days. So I had the answering machine turned on, but with the volume turned up so I could intercept the calls I wanted and just let the dimwits talk to the tape. And the reason I let you talk to the tape as long as I did was because at first you didn't have the slightest idea who I was."
"Jesus, that's right. How did you know that?"
"Because we're forgetting again. All of us this time."
"Mikey, are you sure?"
"What was Stan's last name?" I asked him. There was silence on the other end of the line. A long silence. In it, faintly, I could hear a woman talking in Omaha, or maybe she was in Ruthven, Arizona, or Flint, Michigan. I heard her, as faint as a space traveler leaving the solar system in the nose cone of a burned-out rocket. "Thanks, someone, for the cookies." Then Richie said, uncertainly, "I think it was Underwood, but that isn't Jewish, is it?"
"It was Uris."
"Uris," Richie cried, sounding both relieved and shaken. "Jesus, I hate it when I get something right on the tip of my tongue and can't quite pick it off. Someone brings out a Trivial Pursuit game, I say, 'Excuse me, but I think the diarrhea's coming back, so maybe I'll just go home, okay?' But you remember anyhow, Mikey, like before." "No, I looked it up in my address book." Another long silence. Then,
"You didn't remember?"
"Nope."
"No shit?"
"No shit."
"Then this time it's really over," he said,
and the relief in his voice was unmistakable.
"Yes, I think so."
That long-distance silence fell again, all the miles between Maine and California. I believe we were both thinking the same thing. It was over, yes, and in 6 weeks or 6 months, we will have forgotten all about each other. It's over, and all it's cost us is our friendship and Stan and Eddie's lives. I've almost forgotten them, you know it. Horrible as it may sound, I have almost forgotten Stan and Eddie. Was it asthma Eddie had, or chronic migraine? I'll be damned if I can remember for sure, although I think it was migraine. I'll ask Bill. He'll know. "Well, you say hi to Bill and that pretty wife of his," Richie said with a cheeriness that sounded canned.
"I will, Richie," I said, closing my eyes and rubbing my forehead. He remembered Bill's wife was in Derry, but not her name or what had happened to her. And if you're ever in L.A., you got the number. We'll get together and mouth some chow.
Sure.
I felt hot tears behind my eyes. And if you get back this way, the same thing goes.
Mikey?
Right here.
I love you, man.
Same here. Okay, keep your thumb on it. Beep, beep, Richie. He laughed. Yeah, 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 stick it in your ear, Mike. I say in your ear, boy. He hung up, and so did I. Then I lay back in my pillows with my eyes shut and didn't open them for a long time. June 7th, 1985. Police Chief Andrew Rademacher, who took over from Chief Borden in the late 60s, is dead. It was a bizarre accident, one I can't help associating with what has been happening in Derry, what has just ended in Derry. The combination police station courthouse stands on the edge of the area that fell into the canal, and while it didn't go, the upheaval, or the flood, must have caused structural damage of which no one was aware. Rademacher was working late in his office last night, the story in the paper says, as he has every night since the storm and the flood. The police chief's office has moved from the third to the fifth floor since the old days to just below an attic where all sorts of records and useless city artifacts are stored. One of those artifacts was the tramp chair I have described earlier in these pages. It was made of iron and weighed better than 400 pounds. The building shipped a quantity of water during the downpour of May 31st, and that must have weakened the attic floor, or so the paper says. Whatever the reason, the tramp chair fell from the attic directly onto Chief Rademacher as he sat at his desk reading accident reports. He was killed instantly. Officer Bruce Andine rushed in and found him lying on the ruins of his shattered desk, his pen still in one hand. Talk to Bill on the phone again. Audra is taking some solid food, he says, but otherwise there is no change. I asked him if Eddie's big problem had been asthma or migraine. Asthma, he said promptly. Don't you remember his aspirator?
Sure,
I said, and did. But only when Bill mentioned it.
Mike.
Yeah?
What was his last name?
I looked at my address book lying on the night table, but didn't pick it up.
I don't quite remember.
It was like Kerkorian, Bill said, sounding distressed. But that wasn't quite it. You've got everything written down, though, right?
Right,
I said. Thank God for that.
Have you had any ideas about Audra?
One, he said. But it's so crazy, I don't want to talk about it.
You sure?
Yeah. All right.
Mike, it's scary, isn't it, forgetting like this?
Yes, I said. And it is. June 8th, 1985. Raytheon, which had been scheduled to break ground on its dairy plant in July, has decided at the last minute to build in Waterville instead. The editorial on page one of the news expresses dismay, and if I read correctly between the lines, a little fright.
I think I know what Bill's idea is. He'll have to act quickly before the last of the magic departs this place, if it hasn't already. I guess what I thought before wasn't so paranoid after all. The names and addresses of the others in my little book are fading.
The color and quality of the ink combine to make those entries look as if they were written 50 or 75 years before the others I've jotted in there. This has happened in the last 4 or 5 days. I'm convinced that by September their names will be utterly gone. I suppose I could preserve them. I could just keep copying them. But I'm also convinced that each would fade in its turn, and that very soon it would become an exercise in futility, like writing, I will not throw spitballs in class 500 times. I would be writing names that meant nothing for a reason I didn't remember.
Let it go, let it go.
Bill, act quickly, but be careful. June 9th, 1985. Woke up in the middle of the night from a terrible nightmare I couldn't remember. Got panicky, couldn't breathe. Reached for the call button and then couldn't use it. Had a terrible vision of Mark LaMonica answering the bell with a hypo, or Henry Bowers with his switchblade. I grabbed my address book and called Ben Hanscom in Nebraska. The address and number have faded still more, but they are still legible. No go, Joe. Got a recorded phone company voice telling me service to that number has been canceled. Was Ben fat? Or did he have something like a club foot? Lay awake until dawn. June 10th, 1985. They tell me I can go home tomorrow. I called Bill and told him that. I suppose I wanted to warn him that his time is getting shorter all the time.
Bill is the only one I remember clearly, and I'm convinced that I'm the only one he remembers clearly. Because we are both still here in Derry, I suppose. All right, he said. By tomorrow, we'll be out of your hair. You still got your idea? Yeah. Looks like it's time to try it. Be careful. He laughed and said something I both do and don't understand. You can't be careful on us, hate board man. How will I know how it turned out, Bill? You'll know, he said, and hung up. My heart's with you, Bill, no matter how it turns out. My heart is with all of them, and I think that even if we forget each other, we'll remember in our dreams. I'm almost done with this diary now, and I suppose a diary is all that it will ever be, and that the story of Derry's old scandals and eccentricities has no place outside these pages. That's fine with me. I think that when they let me out of here tomorrow, it might finally be time to start thinking about some sort of new life, although just what that might be is unclear to me. I loved you guys, you know. I loved you so much. Epilogue. Bill Denbro beats the devil. 2. I knew the bride when she used to do the pony. I knew the bride when she used to do the stroll. I knew the bride when she used to want a party. I knew the bride when she used to rock and roll. Nick Lowe. You can't be careful on a skateboard, man. Some kid. 1. Noon of a summer day. Bill stood naked in Mike Hanlon's bedroom, looking at his lean body in the mirror on the door. His bald head gleamed in the light which fell through the window and cast his shadow along the floor and up the wall. His chest was hairless, his thighs and shanks skinny, but overlaid with ropes of muscle. Still, he thought, it's an adult's body we got here, no question about that. There's the pot belly that comes with a few too many good steaks, a few too many bottles of Kirin beer, a few too many poolside lunches where you had the Reuben or the French dip instead of the diet plate. Your seat's dropped too, Bill, old buddy. You can still serve an ace if you're not too hungover and if your eye's in, but you can't hustle after the old Dunlop the way you could when you were 17. You've got love handles and your balls are starting to get that middle-aged dangly look. There's lines on your face that weren't there when you were 17. Hell, they weren't there on your first author photo, the one where you tried so hard to look as if you knew something, anything. You're too old for what you've got in mind, Billy boy. You'll kill both of you. He put on his underpants. If we'd believed that, we never could have done whatever it was we did. Because he didn't really remember what it was they had done, or what had happened to turn Audra into a catatonic wreck. He only knew what he was supposed to do now, and he knew that if he didn't do it now, he would forget that, too. Audra was sitting downstairs in Mike's easy chair, her hair hanging lankly to her shoulders, staring with rapt attention at the TV, which was currently showing Dialing for Dollars. She didn't speak and would only move if you led her. End of side 29. To continue, turn the cassette over.